You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of IAS 2007, the fourth International AIDS Society conference on HIV pathogenesis, treatment, and prevention. Sydney, Australia, July 22nd through July 25th, 2007.
This is Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of the Body Pro. I'm here in Sydney, Australia at IAS 2007 with Dr. Eric Darr. Dr. Darr is chief of the Division of HIV Medicine at Harbor UCLA Medical Center and professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine, UCLA. I'm going to be talking to him about some of the highlights of IAS. So what do you think were the studies at IAS with the most impact in terms of changing clinical practice?
Well, I think that there were probably three that have the potential to have an impact. The one that's most obvious is the PREDICT-1, which was the prospective randomized control trial that looked at individuals who were about to start abacavir for any one of a number of reasons and randomly assigned people to either get HLA-B5701 testing done or not. And it was interesting, the strategy they used, so that people didn't actually know which group the patient was in. So basically, you enrolled the patient and blood was sent off for testing, and you were told if a person had HLA-B5701 and then they wouldn't go into the study. If you weren't told, it either meant because they didn't or because they were in the arm that wasn't tested and you really didn't know. And they followed these people over time, and then they validated the results of any suspected HSR reaction with this skin test, which appears to be fairly reliable for determining whether what's been called HSR is real or not. And the amazing result was that when it was all said and done, the people who were provided HLA-B5701 testing were found to be negative and got abacavir. There were no real cases of HSR. So it's pretty compelling evidence that we can use this test in clinical practice. It doesn't answer all the questions. One of the things that was discussed is that there were a limited number of minorities. And some of that data suggests that it will apply to blacks and Hispanics. But we don't know. So I think what people would propose is that we do the test, if you can get it done in a reliable and way, and also use clinical judgment. But it may suddenly shift the landscape, where up until now we've thought that both abacavir and 3TC and tenofovir and FTC are both viable dual combination nucleosides. Both are relatively lipid-friendly, don't have hematologic toxicity, don't appear to cause a lot in the way of fat changes, and the one big difference has been the hypersensitivity reaction with one and not the other. And if we have a way to determine who those people are, really will force us to look again at the similarities and the differences between those two drugs. So I would hope that from this study, that's going to increasingly become the standard of care, that there will be competition amongst commercial labs to develop reliable and hopefully reasonably inexpensive tests.
Uh-huh. Have you been able to use the test in your practice?
We have not, and it's mostly been related to the ability to get a reliable test and have a third-party payer pay for it. Uh-huh. I'm hoping that this will change all of that, because it could make a big difference. Uh-huh. So that one, I think, should make a difference. The other two studies or themes that came out of the meeting that might influence things, one is the TITAN study. And the TITAN study was just published in Lancet, and it was a randomized controlled trial of early failure patients who they weren't necessarily early failure, but they were lopinavir-ritonavir naive, and they got randomly assigned to soft gel capsules, lopinavir-ritonavir or darunavir-ritonavir. And the goal was to look at safety and efficacy, and the primary endpoint was non-inferiority of darunavir to lopinavir-ritonavir. And then they had secondary endpoints that included looking at superiority. And in their primary analysis, they did indeed show non-inferiority. In their secondary analysis, they showed actual superiority. The big limitation of the study, I think there are two. One is that the baseline characteristics of the population were not necessarily balanced, and that there were a larger proportion of people at baseline who were resistant to lopinavir-ritonavir than resistant to darunavir-ritonavir. And that may have driven the results to some extent. And they attempted to look at that in a variety of ways in the study, as well as in a resistance poster presented here. And it doesn't seem like it explains all of it. And there may be some real differences, but it certainly explains some of it. And in clinical practice, we wouldn't do that. If we had a patient we were looking to start a new PI on, we would do susceptibility testing. And if they were resistant to lopinavir-ritonavir and they had another option, we wouldn't give them lopinavir-ritonavir. So that's what separated this study a little bit from the way clinical practice goes. The other thing is then, you know, if you say that there may be some differences in efficacy, or at the very least non-inferiority, and I think everybody would agree it's probably non-inferior at the very least, then you'd look at things like tolerability. And from a tolerability perspective, they were actually fairly similar in many ways, including for lipids. The biggest difference was there was more diarrhea in the people with lopinavir ritonavir, and there was more rash in the people who got darunavir ritonavir. The caveat there is that for the lopinavir ritonavir, they used the soft gel capsules. And while we don't have good data yet showing the differences in tolerability between the tablets, which are now more commonly used, and the soft gel capsules, I think there's a sense that there's probably going to be less diarrhea. So again, it'll make it a little difficult to completely extrapolate these results to what we do in clinical practice, at least in the States and throughout Western Europe.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think it'll change the sequencing of darunavir? It'll no longer be for salvage patients, it'll be more for early failure?
I think it'll certainly convince many people that, that's a viable option to move it up. Sequencing as far as, you know, so what happens if I move darunavir, ritonavir up and people fail that is unknown because we haven't had any experience at all. There was some intriguing data presented here showing the number of people who developed new resistant mutations, and it did seem to favor darunavir, ritonavir over lopinavir, ritonavir, even after they controlled for that whole baseline resistance issue. Mm-hmm. So I think people will look at it differently, and certainly based on the data, it would not be unreasonable to think about moving it up. I just don't know that it's the definitive study to answer the question. So then there was the third area that was addressed at this meeting, not with any single study, but that was with regards to this recurring theme of when should we be starting therapy and should the guidelines suggest that we start people earlier. And I think what generated some of the discussion was a presentation here as a poster from the SMART study. So the limitation has always been that we don't have a randomized controlled trial looking at early versus late therapy. Well, within the SMART trial, where people were randomly assigned to either continuous therapy or to not start treatment until their T cells were less than 250, there were a subset of individuals within that study who were not on therapy at baseline. So there were about 10% of the people, which were several hundred, that in each group, who were, in essence were a study of immediate therapy with CD4s of greater than 350 versus deferred therapy until CD4s were less than 250. And they did indeed show, although the number of events were small, they were significantly higher, whether it was opportunistic diseases or death or non-AIDS-related events, that it all favored the people who got started on therapy early.
Rather than the treatment naive. They were treatment naive.
These were, in essence, people who were off treatment, many treatment naive. Mm-hmm. So it's the first study. It wasn't designed to look at that question, but you know, we have the data from that study that suggests being off therapy may be bad. And then we have this smaller data set, but suggesting in a head-to-head comparison, in essence, that the people who got started earlier were better than late. And it emphasized the point that maybe in these people who are starting early, the events we should be looking for are not necessarily traditional AIDS events. And the whole issue of whether people off therapy are at higher risk for cardiovascular disease, renal disease, and hepatic disease. So we're left with some data suggesting earlier therapy might be better in a head-to-head comparison. We're left with data from SMART and others suggesting that having viremia is a bad thing. There was another presentation here showing that looking at a non-invasive marker of cardiovascular disease, this brachial artery reactants, that people who were started on therapy had improvements in flow, which is a good thing, kind of like what you see when you start people on lipid-lowering therapy or you get people to stop smoking. So we have this growing body of evidence that having viremia is bad, and the balance of not starting therapy based on that is, you know, the overall risks of treatment failure and toxicity and resistance. And those were the main reasons why we stopped treating early in the first place. And I think we now know that our drugs are much safer and better tolerated and are less likely to fail. So with all of that information, you really do, I think, need to start considering when we start treatment. From a clinical perspective, the majority of the patients I have who aren't on therapy for a really good reason. It's because they have too many social issues and problems with drugs and alcohol and psychiatric disease that really limit their ability to take their medications consistently. But it may be time that in those people who are ready, willing, and able to commit to therapy whenever we think it's appropriate, to really be seriously considering it in people with higher T cell counts.
What's the new number?
Well, I don't think we're going to know. The SMART study would suggest 350 may be a reasonable way to start. You know, it's all the best guess. And I think 350, based upon the SMART study, based upon other treatment interruption studies that didn't show adverse outcomes, where they used the 350 cutoff for starting therapy, staccato, exactly, all of that would suggest that that might be a reasonable place to start. You know, the discussion that went along with the session was, well, the guidelines don't say not to start at 350. Mm-hmm. They suggest between 200 and 350 to sort of offer treatment. And maybe it's time to make those guidelines a little bit stronger, that for the person ready, willing, and able to commit, that we really should be offering therapy at greater than 350, a little closer to what we're now saying at 200, and make a stronger statement.
What do you think was the most important advance in our understanding of HIV and treatment and care in the last year or so? I mean, related to this, is the conversation about when to start like the newest thing in 2007, 2006 because of SMART?
Yeah, I think from a treatment perspective, when to start is probably going to have a big impact, particularly if the CDC guidelines are ever implemented widely and that we really are testing people regularly and we identify the other 200,000 or 300,000 people in the United States, for example, who are infected and don't know it. That may be a real issue. So I think we need to continue to have that dialogue, and probably has the potential to impact the most patients. We tend in practice to focus more on a much smaller group of individuals, and those are our patients who have multi-drug resistant virus. And they get a lot of attention, in particularly at these meetings. And as we've seen the new drugs move forward into expanded access, and we're anticipating potentially having three new drugs available by the end of this year, the beginning of next year, I think that it's thinking strategically more than ever. We've always tried to say we did that, but when you have no options for people, there's not a lot of strategy. Mm-hmm. When you start having a lot of options, I think that we realize that we need to be extremely careful how we use the drugs that are available now, not necessarily waste new PIs like tipranovir and dabrunavir if we don't have good combinations to use with them, saving T20 until we have a good combination to use with it, and then start thinking about how we're going to start integrating three new drugs into clinical practice. Because mm-hmm. for many people, it's not going to be just throw everything we have at them. That might work, but it'll come at the risk of toxicity, and if they fail, having limited options after that. Mm-hmm. It may be thinking very seriously about which of the drugs we need. Do we need one new active drug, two new active drugs? Can we save some, and which ones to save? And I think those are the things that we need to be thinking about over the last 6 months, and are going to probably need to take even more seriously in the coming year.
Uh-huh. Related to that, I wanted to ask you a question about eradication. I don't know if you saw the publication, Journal of Infectious Diseases, where Dr. Fauci suggested that because of the strength of these new medications, we might be closer to eradicating HIV than ever before. What was your feeling about that?
Well, I would love to be optimistic about it, and I still think it's a worthwhile sort of area to explore and try to better understand, but it just seems like we are nowhere close to being able to even begin to think about eradicating HIV from the body. I don't think we completely even understand what's going on in various compartments, both in the peripheral blood and in potential reservoirs like the brain and the genital tract. So I'm not as optimistic. But, you know, the next best thing to eradication is long-term suppression. And we're certainly there for most people. And I think we're going to be there for even more with the availability of new drugs.
Uh-huh. And one of my final questions is, do you think we're any closer in understanding the metabolic complications of HIV, how they occur, and how to intervene to help them?
Well, you know, I think we have a better understanding about how drugs cause various complications like dyslipidemia and glucose dysregulation, and how subcutaneous fat loss relates to select drugs, particularly the nucleosides. And I think we've made a lot of progress there. But I think there are many things we still don't understand, including the relationship between HIV and therapy and fat accumulation syndromes. And more intriguing data recently suggesting that NNRTIs may be contributing from the head-to-head comparison.
The 5142.
5142, comparing people receiving same nucleosides with either efavirenz versus lopinavir or ritonavir. and seeing a greater loss of subcutaneous fat with NNRTIs. I don't think we understand the mechanism of that. Uh-huh.
So there's still a lot of work to do.
A lot of work to do. But my hope is that with most of the regimens that we're using in the current era, that it's going to be a minor problem. Because even in 5142, if you really focused on the people that received the non-thymidine analog nucleosides, although there was still a difference between lipoatrophy and those who received efavirenz versus lopinavir or ritonavir, the overall number in both groups was very, very small.
Uh-huh. And what about cardiovascular complications? Do you think we're closer to figuring out about whether it's HIV or heart or lifestyle?
It seems
genetics?
Like, yeah, it seems like there's been a lot of progress. I think everybody has to always remind ourselves that the biggest risk factors are probably still the usual ones like smoking and dyslipidemia. And I think there's a lot of modifiable risk factors that we should be targeting in our patients. But the intriguing information that it's more than just the effect of drugs on lipids and cardiovascular disease. Some of this information about viremia and inflammation. Mm-hmm. There was at one of the sessions, there was a presentation from SMART again where they did this nested case-controlled study where they planned to look at lots of biomarkers. But one they looked at was D-dimers, which is a blood marker of risk for cardiovascular and cerebrovascular disease. And they showed very nicely in the population of patients who weren't on therapy coming into the study that the levels of D-dimer were higher than HIV negative patients have been seen, HIV negative individuals, and when they started them on treatment, that the level of D-dimers went down. That, along with the data from, again, a sub-study of 5142, showing this other non-invasive marker of brachial artery reactants, that you saw improvements in flow in people whose viral loads were reduced, regardless of what therapy they received. I think we're starting to get a handle on the fact that there's a lot more to this than dyslipidemia and glucose abnormalities, that it may very well be related to chronic inflammation associated with HIV.
And finally, do you think that a circumcision should be adapted in the developed world for HIV prevention? And if not, why not?
Well, you know, I think that there was a very nice presentation yesterday where the point was made that the bar was very, very high to move forward on this strategy, and I think for good reasons. But we now have three large randomized controlled trials in the developing world where the epidemic is, there's a high prevalence of HIV, and a large proportion of that is driven by women transmission to men. And in that setting, I think it seems very clear that you protect HIV-negative men from infection from women if they're circumcised on the order of 60%, which is pretty dramatic and probably need to move forward. The presentation also included things like, you know, how much it would cost, how many circumcisions you would need to do to prevent an infection. And that's going to all be determined based upon the prevalence of infection within the community and the nature of the epidemic. And it's clear that if you don't have a lot of infection in the community and or the epidemic is not being driven by women to men, or at least to a substantial proportion, you can't use this data to make any decisions. So when you start thinking about this strategy in the developed world, where the epidemic is still mostly men having sex with men, men transmitting to heterosexual women and needle sharing, I don't think we have the data to justify this kind of an intervention, which is going to have some morbidity and mortality and certainly substantial cost associated with it.
Uh-huh. And I don't think there are any studies planned yet for studying this in the developed world.
I don't think so. I think that probably the next step is to try to sort out whether there's a rationale for doing it. Mm-hmm. The rationale for doing it in the developing world was the fact that, you know, there's all this epidemiologic data that suggested that in communities where circumcision was more common, HIV infection amongst men was much lower, heterosexual men was much lower. Mm-hmm. I think we need that kind of epidemiologic data. There was a presentation today from a group in Australia where they looked at this HIV in men cohort, where they looked at a population of HIV negative men who have sex with men. They followed them over time. They had about two-thirds that were circumcised and a full third that weren't. And they simply looked at the incidence of infection over a relatively short period of time, and they found absolutely no difference whatsoever in incident infections amongst those who were circumcised versus those who weren't. And that included, interestingly enough, about 40% of them described themselves as always being insertive. Because that's the other part of it. I mean, right now, at least the way we believe circumcision is protecting men, it's when they're the insertive partner. Mm-hmm. So you could argue that it's little reason to believe it would protect a man from acquiring HIV if they were the receptive partner. But if they're, you know, in a subgroup of people that were 40% said they were only insertive, and despite that, although the numbers are small, they weren't able to see a difference. There are other studies that have suggested otherwise, so I think we need more information.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on IAS 2007 from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/IAS2007.